Welcome back to our series on Jeremiah and the Faithful Remnant. This is study number 14, and this series is being sponsored by the Christadelphian Video Service. And we also would remind you that there are some documents you can download which support this study. The chronology of Jeremiah and the speeches of Jeremiah are very available to you if you just go onto the website and download those documents. So we come now to look at study number 14, and it's under the theme of Ezekiel and Jeremiah, educating the remnant. And you might say, well, I thought we were dealing with Jeremiah. Well, we need to understand that Jeremiah had a 40-year prophecy period, 40 years and 6 months, actually, of his prophecy, and then after that, some time in Egypt as well. And the reason we're dealing with Ezekiel is that it overlaps with some of the years of Ezekiel. Ezekiel having been in Babylon at the captivity of Jehoiachin, it overlaps with Jeremiah considerably, and we get some insights into Jeremiah from the book of Ezekiel. But there is going to be a tremendous connection between the two. Now, remember when we're dealing with Jeremiah and Ezekiel, that we're actually dealing with a situation that happened in Jerusalem, but had commentary on it from Babylon. So we're going to see this connection between the two. Ezekiel was in an interesting position. He was the foreign correspondent in Babylon. Now, these days, of course, we're used to a news cycle where we can get instant news on every subject and just watch news 24 hours a day. But you imagine what it was like for those Jews back in the land, wondering about what's happened to those who've been taken away, and especially as the ones that had been taken away were many of the younger people, or those in Babylon whose children were still back in Jerusalem, wondering about their families back in Jerusalem. And they didn't have television they could turn on, or radio, or even any information. They couldn't get on the phone and ring somebody up. The Jews in Babylon had no information unless it came, as it occasionally did, by a letter, or on this particular case, it came through Ezekiel the prophet. So they had a prophet, and only one prophet that was talking about events back in Jerusalem. Daniel was getting prophecies towards the end of the 70 years, which had to do with the great world scene that Daniel was describing and the time of the end and so forth. But when it came to information in these last years of King Zedekiah, they had to rely almost entirely upon what came through Ezekiel. So he was entitled, what we would say, we would entitle him a foreign correspondent in Babylon, giving the Jews in Babylon the information about Jerusalem. So Ezekiel overlaps with Jeremiah in the last 6 years of the kingdom of Judah. Now, we know that the lesson from the prophets is something we've talked about in almost every study, where we're told by James to take the prophets for an example of suffering, affliction, and of patience. And we're going to see a tremendous suffering, affliction in the case of Ezekiel, and a tremendous patience in the case of Ezekiel, which actually parallels that of Jeremiah. So we're going to see a connection between these two men in quite a remarkable way. At the outset, we need to realize that, like Jeremiah, Ezekiel was also a type of Christ. Both Jeremiah and Ezekiel started their mission at the age of 30. Both prophesied the imminent fall of Jerusalem at the end of the Jewish state. Both exposed Jewish religion as hypocrisy. Both attracted the Jewish leaders to listen, but were ignored or opposed. And both bore the title, the Son of Man. And that's an interesting connection between Ezekiel and Christ. They both were called the Son of Man, but with a very essential difference. And I want to just explore that difference first about the title that God uses for Ezekiel, Son of Man. It's used 92 times of Ezekiel by God. And the first is in chapter 2, verse 1. Where God begins to address him personally and calls him Son of Man. In the Hebrew, that is Ben Adam, the builder of the human race. And what that's indicating is that as God talks to Ezekiel, he's talking to all the human race, all the sons of Adam, all of us sinners are included in that Son of Man title. So we need to take on board the things that are said to Ezekiel because they're revealing to us the mind of God, and he represents us in these transactions. It is so different to what happens in the Gospels. There, 81 times, Jesus is called the Son of Man. Not Son of Man, We know that he was a human being like us, that he shared our temptations and our lusts. But when you come to the title, the Son of Man, it's not focusing upon his humanity. It's focusing upon the fact that he was the special child that God made strong for himself. And so you read in Psalm 80, verse 17, he was the Son of Man that God made strong for himself. So God took an ordinary human being, a human body, and prepared that body. He gave him a susceptibility to divine thinking so that he could become a sinless person, that he could achieve the great sacrifice that God had foreseen, and that he would reverse the suffering that was brought by Adam into the world. So here was a very particular Son of Man, the Son of Man, a very special Son of Man that God would make strong for himself. So there's a big difference between the way it's used about Ezekiel and the way it's used about the Lord Jesus Christ. Ezekiel is never called the Son of Man, only Son of Man. Jesus is never called Son of Man, he's called the Son of Man. And so you can see that essential difference between the two and the different roles they had to play. One represents the human race. All of us need to listen to these words of God. The other one is the Son of Man that would save the world through the work of God in him. So let's pick that up now and pick up the history of where we are. We're taking to the captivity into Babylon, the captivity of Jehoiachin. So the Babylonians had come down. They had killed evil King Jehoiakim, and on their way back, they took Jehoiachin, who only reigned for 3 months, and they took him off to Babylon with his mother, Nehushta, as we saw in an earlier study. They both went to Babylon only after a 3 month reign. And in this captivity of Jehoiachin, which then ended up with Zedekiah on the throne, in this captivity of Jehoiachin, Ezekiel and his wife were taken away captive to Babylon also. So here is Ezekiel taken away, and 5 years later, in the fifth year of Zedekiah, he becomes a foreign correspondent. And frequently, God then takes him in vision back to Jerusalem to describe to the Jews in Babylon what's going on back in Jerusalem and why that is happening to them. He was their only source of information, and that makes him a very important person as he's prophesying in Babylon. As we said, in those days, there was no communication. There was no television, radio, no internet, no news other than what Ezekiel could tell them. The Jewish leaders often came to sit before Ezekiel and to hear what he had to say. And when you look at chapter 8, verse 1 of Ezekiel, chapter 14, verse 1, and chapter 20, verse 1, we find they often came to his house and sat there. And sometimes they sat there while he was in astonished silence. And he could only speak when he was able to explain the visions or the mimes that he was performing before them. They wanted to know what was happening back in Jerusalem, but they didn't like the message that was ultimately being delivered. Now, the exiles were very worried and very sad. We know the words of Psalm 137, where it says, you know, we wept in Babylon, we remembered Zion, we hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. People saying, sing us a song, but we couldn't sing because our hearts were sad and sorrowful. And this was a very difficult time for the Jews. They could not believe that God would go on to destroy their land, that God would destroy his temple, that the people of Abraham would be carted away and defeated by Gentiles. And so they kept their hopes up. And unfortunately, Ezekiel had the job of telling them that it was all in vain. So, you know, they were a worried people. And so they came to Ezekiel that they might get some news about what was going to happen back in Jerusalem. Now, Ezekiel also had the problem, not only of the elders who didn't want to listen, but he had the problems of the false prophets in Babylon. We've talked about these people before. There are a number of people over in Babylon who actually were prophesying against the words of Jeremiah and against the words of Ezekiel. And eventually these two, Ahab and Zedekiah, would be roasted by the king of Babylon. For them, there would be no salvation. Back in Jerusalem, in the fourth year of Zedekiah, Jeremiah was dealing with Hananiah that we looked at in a previous study, and his false prophecy about the exiles coming back within 2 years of the captivity. Again, a very false promise, a lot of lies. And we know what happened to Hananiah, that God killed him in that same year. But again, there was this problem of false information being delivered, both in Jerusalem and in Babylon.
when we come to look at the book of Ezekiel, and we're going to see his connection to Jeremiah, but we can't miss some of the major themes of Ezekiel. One of the key statements that comes up again and again in the book of Ezekiel is this statement, "And the heathen shall know that I, Yahweh, do sanctify Israel." Chapter 38, verse 23, "They shall know that I am Yahweh." Chapter 39, verse 6, "They shall know that I am Yahweh." This is a very frequent statement through the book of Ezekiel. It's usually at the beginning, at the end, or a beginning of a section of the scripture, but the end result is always the same, that when God has done what he said he's going to do, then people will eventually and gradually recognize that God is supreme. They will know that he is the God who promises and delivers. His plan will surely come to pass. And so many of the prophecies of Ezekiel are paraphrased with this little phrase, "When this comes to pass, they shall know that I am Yahweh." So there's the theme statement of Ezekiel. But when we look at a bigger picture of the book of Ezekiel, there's even a more glorious theme than the vindication of God. And it's the theme of the glory. So in chapter 1, the vision of the cherubim, the glory appears before Ezekiel. In chapter 10, verse 4, Ezekiel sees the glory preparing to leave. It comes out of the holy place and comes to the threshold of the sanctuary. And then it moves to the eastern gate of the temple in chapter 10, verse 18. And then it departs to the Mount of Olives in chapter 11, verse 23. And then we come to the restoration chapters from chapter 33 to 39, where we see the preparation for the glory to return. And, of course, that is 33, 30, 31 in that order, should be included in that restoration prophecy. It's the preparation stage of them coming back to the land. And then finally, when we have the picture of Ezekiel's temple, the glory of God comes in by way of the east from the Mount of Olives through the eastern gate and fills the mountain of God with the glory of the Father. And this is another theme of Ezekiel that you can follow through, but that's not the course of our study today. So there are some of the larger views of Ezekiel, but let's talk about Ezekiel himself. His story is quite a remarkable one, and his place in the scripture is quite an unusual one. His name very simply means God will strengthen, and you can see that, of course, was something about Ezekiel that would be true. He was born into a priestly family. He went into captivity at the age of 25. At the age of 30, which was the normal time for a priest to be called to service, then he was called to be a prophet. And you can find this in chapter 1. Ezekiel was in the fifth year of his captivity, of Jehoiachin's captivity, he was called into service. So he's been there for 5 years, and he now becomes God's prophet in Babylon. Every single thing we know about Ezekiel comes from his own book. There is no mention of Ezekiel anywhere else, except perhaps by included in the prophets who suffered, but no specific mention about Ezekiel anywhere else in the Bible. Remarkably, his name appears only twice in the Bible, and they are both in the book of Ezekiel. You find that in chapter 1, verse 3, and you find it in chapter 24 and verse 24. Let's just look at those particular quotations. Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 3, where it says, "The word of Yahweh came expressly unto Ezekiel." That means only to Ezekiel. It came deliberately, intentionally to one man, to Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river of Kibar. And the hand of Yahweh was there upon him. So that's one mention of Ezekiel's name. The other one is in chapter 24 and verse 24, where God says that Ezekiel shall be to them a sign. And we're going to look at that one in its context a bit more later on. But only twice in the Bible is the name Ezekiel there. Here's even more remarkable things. Ezekiel is not directly quoted in any other book. You can find similar metaphors that Ezekiel uses coming up in Revelation, for example, about birds eating the flesh and things like that. You can find mentions of the worship of the age to come. You can find mentions of the divisions of the land, which Ezekiel talks about. You can find allusions to these things in other places. What you don't find is any direct quotation from Ezekiel into any other book in the Bible, which, of course, is quite remarkable. However, look how much we depend upon the book of Ezekiel for information about the plan of God, the revival of Israel, the prophecies of Armageddon. And we're talking now about chapters 36, 37, 38 of Ezekiel, chapter 39, the temple, chapter 40 to 48, the future of Israel. All of that information comes from the book of Ezekiel, and we are greatly indebted to Ezekiel or recording these things. What we don't get in Ezekiel is what we get in Jeremiah, where Jeremiah has arguments with God, where he tries to resign, where he expresses his feelings of disappointment with God. All of those things that Jeremiah did and his individual prayers, none of that in Ezekiel. But we do get some clues in some of God's comments about the feelings of this man. So let's go now to a chapter 1, verse 1, and think about this prophecy of Ezekiel. Remember I said in chapter 1, verse 1, it was the 30th year. We believe that's the 30th year of his age. In the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, I was among the captains of the river of Kiba. So this is when he turns 30, which is the time of his elevation to be a priest normally. Of course, there is no one in Babylon to be a priest for. There's no temple, there's no sacrifices. He had no job to do in Babylon. So he became a prophet. We know from later on he was happily married, and his wife dies 9 years from the time of their captivity, and that, of course, is used by God as one of the great signs that they would be given. He became God's prophet because he could not be a priest. But we believe that Ezekiel and his wife had come from a very good training ground. As they grew up back in Jerusalem before the days of Zedekiah, they would have lived in the years of Josiah and the years of Jehoiakim. And they would have heard both Jeremiah and Josiah trying to lead the people in the right way. They would have heard Urijah the prophet repeating the words of Jeremiah. They would have listened to the speeches of Jeremiah. Perhaps they were in his Sunday school group and his youth group. And they came to Babylon as faithful people that God could use to accomplish his purpose. So by the time they arrived, Daniel has been there 7 years. And you notice when you go to the book of Ezekiel that he actually refers to Daniel as a contemporary. And quite remarkably that we have this use of Daniel in the book of Ezekiel as a person that could normally save things by his prayers. But of course, in the case of Ezekiel, he knew Daniel at a very early age. And of course, you know, the only prayers of Daniel we have in those early days was, of course, the prayers that he made in relation to Daniel's image. So, but again, he was noted for his praying for other people. And quite remarkable, isn't it, that Ezekiel should mention Daniel as an example of praying for others. So only 7 years into Daniel's captivity, Ezekiel is writing his book. Well, Ezekiel's prophecy was to be a very unusual one. He became a man of sign. And this is Ezekiel 24, verse 24. Thus Ezekiel is unto you a sign. According to all that he hath done, shall ye do, and when this cometh, he shall know that I am Adonai Yahweh. So why did he have to be a sign? Well, he was beginning his prophecy in the fifth year of Zedekiah. And so 30th year, it was the fifth year of Zedekiah. And this is just after the letter that Jeremiah had written had arrived in Babylon. So this is the words of Jeremiah 29, the letter that was sent over there and was to be read to all the captives in Babylon that they should settle down, plant vineyards, build homes, and pray for the peace of Babylon. A letter that was regarded highly by the Jews as treason, but nevertheless was the word of God that had to be read out. And from the time of that letter arriving, there was virtually no contact with Jerusalem except through the visions of Ezekiel. So Ezekiel became a man of sign, but he was given a very unusual way to reveal himself. And I want you to come to Ezekiel chapter 4 and just pick up the fact that he was to do these signs. And God, having given him a vision of a little scroll, it says in chapter 3 of Ezekiel, let's just go to chapter 3 first. He was to eat a scroll. So again, this was a mime. This was something he had to do, something he did in vision. And the important part about eating this scroll was that he was getting information from God that he had to reveal to the people, but he had to do it by doing it in a strange way. So why was this the case? Well, when you come to Ezekiel chapter 3, God tells him that in verse 26, I will make thy tongue cleave to the roof of thy mouth, and thou shalt be dumb. And this is because God knew that the people in Babylon did not want to listen to the words that were going to be said. They didn't want to receive the unwelcome message that the city and the temple was going to be destroyed. They didn't want to know that some of their children would die as that siege came to an end. They didn't want to know a lot of the things that Ezekiel had to say. So God says, look, I'm going to make it harder for them. I'm not going to make it easier. And one of the ways I'm going to do that, Ezekiel, is I'm going to make you basically dumb as to your own words. The only time you will be able to speak is when I give you permission to explain one of the visions or one of the mimes that you have done. And go, so God says in verse 26 of chapter 3, I will make thy tongue cleave to the roof of thy mouth. Thou shalt be dumb. Thou shalt not be to them a reprover, for they are a rebellious house. But when I speak with thee, so when I give you a vision, I give you a speech to make, I will open your mouth, and you shall say unto them, thus saith Yahweh, he that heareth, let him hear. Doesn't that remind you of the Lord Jesus Christ? And he that forbeareth, let him forbear. For they are a rebellious house. So because of their innate rebelliousness and unwillingness to listen, and their reaction to the letter of Jeremiah, God said, I know they don't want to listen. And I'm going to make it harder and harder for them by making you do signs. So when we come to chapter 4, he begins to do some of these signs. And the first one was to make a scale model on a tile, a scale model of Jerusalem, and then to show them in that scale model the battering rams that would be coming, so the siege that was going on, an iron pan would be there, a wall between you and the city, and a very intricate model of Jerusalem. And, you know, he was to show them that this was the coming siege that would go against that city. So here we are in the fifth year of Zedekiah, talking about the ninth year of Zedekiah. And again, the prophecy was there, and they had to try and ponder what this meant. And then in verse 4, he had to lie upon his side for 390 days on one side and then 40 days on the other side. And you can imagine every day that for over a year, he would trundle out his mattress and lie down on one side. And then after doing that for a year and a month, he would then lie on the other side. And people are going to say, what does that mean? And again, they had to try and work it out. And this, of course, was pointing out some of the time of the siege. And, you know, we won't go into explaining all of that, but this was, again, talking about the time of the siege that it would undertake. And they would have to inquire. And Jeremiah could not say anything to them unless God gave him permission to do so. He was actually struck dumb for about 6 years. And quite an amazing thing that should be the case. He had no opportunity to give them his own words. Then we come down to chapter 4, verse 9 to 17, where he actually has this thing where he's told to go and to cook his meal with dung. And God very kindly lets him off and to use animal dung rather than human dung. But again, what a terrible thing to have to do, you know, to cook your meal with the dung of animals. And again, they couldn't work it out. So again, God made it harder for them. I want you to just notice a really interesting little comment that God makes in chapter 3. Chapter 3 and verse 20, look what God says. We're reading verse 19 for context. If you warn the wicked and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, look at this. And I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die, because you have not given him warning, but I will require his blood at your hand. But just notice what God says there. Where a righteous man turns from his righteousness, as humans we might think, well, oh, God will chase him back, God will do everything he can to bring him back. When a man deliberately decides to move away from his God, God says this, I'll put a stumbling block in front of him. Now, it might be to trip him up and to make him think. It might be to make it harder for him. And this is exactly what happened with Balaam, when Balaam was determined to go with the princes of Moab. And God said, well, if the men call you, you can go. And of course, he didn't wait for that to happen. But it got harder and harder for him to discern what was right and wrong. And I think what God is saying here, that in verse 20 of chapter 3, that if you deliberately decide to turn away from God, he will not make it easier for you. He'll actually put stumbling blocks in your way. So going back to Ezekiel, picking up in chapter 5 now, another sign, he was to cut his hair off. And this is an unusual sign. He was to become the human billboard. He was to weigh some in a balance, to burn some and cast some to the wind. And again, this was again indicating the fate of the city, that they would be destroyed. Some would burn in the fires. Some would be cast to the wind, that is, taken away captive. And of course, you know, this was about the end of the siege. So again, another sign he had to do. And then in chapter 12, of course, we have the parable of Zedekiah trying to get under the wall. So this was all giving them information about what was coming back in Jerusalem and why. Now, the why comes in chapter 8 when he has the vision of the hole in the wall. And it's like God puts a projector through the brains of the elders in Jerusalem and shows the wickedness and the abominations in their hearts. And this is revealed to those in Babylon. This is the reason why God is going to have to destroy that city and that temple. So, you know, this is the signs that he had to use. He was unable to speak his own words right up until chapter 33. We find that he could not speak his own words. All he could do was on occasions just repeat the words that God had dictated to him and then say no more about it. And, you know, this is a remarkable thing, isn't it? It was a great challenge for people to think and to try and work it out. But God said, I know that they won't listen, and therefore I'm going to make it harder and harder for them to work it out. And God was setting a stumbling block before them in some of these things that he did. Well, we now come to the very sad story in chapter 24, which is the loss of his wife. And when you think what the prophets of God suffered by ways of torture and imprisonment and mocking, you know, this is remarkable that Ezekiel was to be a man of sign to them in the things that would happen to him concerning his wife. And so we pick up the story about this. In chapter 24, we're now in the ninth year, the 10th month, the 10th day of the month. Why do we get such specific information about that? Why do we get that information? I want you to think about that for a while. So coming back to Ezekiel 24, let's just pick up this story about his wife again. Reading Ezekiel 24, and we're going to pick this up from verse 15. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes with a stroke. Yet neither shall thou mourn nor weep, neither shall thy tears run down. Forbear to cry, make no mourning for the dead. Don't bind attire upon your head. Put on your shoes, cover not your lips, and eat not the bread of men. So he's given this promise by God that his wife is about to die. And, you know, those two, that couple, who were obviously a loving couple, because God describes her as the desire of his eyes, that this was to happen to him in a way which was incredible to think of the individual suffering this inflicted upon the prophet Ezekiel. Now, you think about what happened here. Reading from verse 18, I spake unto the people in the morning. So this vision seemed to have come sometimes during the night, that he got this indication from God that his wife was going to die the next day. So they've got the day to think about it. He goes out and he tells the people and told them what God has said, that he's going to lose his wife that night. So they had that the rest of that night and the rest of that day to console themselves that this was in the will of God, that this should be so. We never read of any children in this marriage, so that's something to think about, how God will reward that. However, they were a loving couple. And this is an incredibly powerful sign that God requires of him, to take away the desire of his eyes. And he was not to show any mourning in public. Look what happens. In the morning, and even my wife died. So again, after one rest of one night and one day, they actually came to the next night, and she died in the evening. And I did in the next morning as I was commanded. So he only had that night then to mourn the loss of his wife. So he could mourn privately, but then he went out on the street the next morning with no apparent signs of mourning. And the people would be asking him, why are you doing this? You just lost your wife. Why don't you actually show some mourning? Because you know how much Jews love to mourn. They're very great at public mourning. But it was not to be so for Ezekiel. He was not to go out and to mourn publicly in any way. So you can imagine he's wondering what this is all about. And this is an incredible price to pay. But I want you to notice the phrase, the desire of your eyes, in verse 15. It occurs again in verse 21. It occurs again in verse 25. So we need to see that this is connected. So what has happened to his wife is a parable of something that's going to happen to the nation. Because they are God's bride. They are God's chosen ecclesia. And God is going to take away what is the desire of their eyes. And you can see this in verse 21. So this is what he was given the explanation by God in verse 21. I answered them, the word of Yahweh came to me saying, and here's the explanation of losing his wife and not mourning. Thus says Yahweh, behold, I will profane my sanctuary, the excellency of your strength, the desire of your eyes. So everything about their land, their temple, their priesthood, their chosen status before God, everything that they held so dear as Jews, God said, the desire of your eyes, that particularly in that temple, and your sons and daughters shall fall by the sword. And you're going to be so distraught that you will do as I have done. You won't go and publicly mourn and put on a show of mourning. You know, you're going to be mourning everyone quietly and pine away quietly on your own. And in verse 23, it says that your tires shall be on your head, your shoes upon your feet. You shall not mourn nor weep, but you shall pine away for your iniquities and mourn one toward another. I want you to notice that. You see, the Jews are noted for public demonstrations of mourning. You know, it was the sackcloth and the ashes and the great processions and the weeping and the wailing and the, you know, the things Jesus and the apostles had to put up with and drive them out because they were there to be professional mourners. That's the Jewish custom. But no, says God, when this happens, you're going to be so, so upset. You will go quietly into your own chamber and you will mourn and cry only with perhaps husband and wife together. I want you to think about where you read about a similar phrase to that. And it's in the end of Zechariah 12 when the Jews are forced to recognize that they crucified their Messiah. And it says the house of David apart, you know, all those different houses apart, everyone going, man and wife separating to go to privately mourn in total and utter repentance and utter humiliation and in utter sorrow for what they did to their own Messiah. There'll be no public mourning in that day. And this is what this is about. Their grief will be so, so intense when Jerusalem and the temple fall and their children are killed that they will mourn privately. And they won't have any public show. And that's why Jeremiah couldn't have any public show for his wife to try and predict to them that this was going to happen to them. Now, I want you to notice the dating of this chapter. You know, Ezekiel 24 starts with the ninth year, the 10th month, the 10th day of the month. Why so specific? That was the exact day that the siege of Jerusalem started. Isn't that amazing? It was the exact day the siege in Jerusalem started. And so this terrible cost for the prophet takes place. His beloved wife is taken away to demonstrate to the Jews that God is going to destroy their city and their temple and their children for the iniquities of that nation that they have been suffering for. And look what God says. Coming over to verse 25, and thou, son of man, shall it not be in the day when I take from them their strength, that is their confidence in their being the people of God, the joy of their glory, their temple, the desire of their eyes, and that whereupon they set their minds, their sons and their daughters. The things that matter to them is their status as the people of God, the temple of the living God that they have, and their children are all going to go. And look what God now says. When I've done that, he that escapes in that day shall come unto thee and cause you to hear it with your ears. So, you know, there wasn't an immediate broadcast, oh, Jerusalem has fallen. It took a long time for a man who got out of the city when that battle finally concluded to go the 800 miles up to Haran, down to Babylon, to bring news the city was fallen. And that took several months for the news to arrive. So let's look what now happens. Because God says in verse 27, when that man arrives, when the destruction of Jerusalem is confirmed by an escapee, in that day, verse 27, shall your mouth be open to him that is escaped? You'll be able to talk to that man like you can't normally talk to people, and you shall speak and be no more dumb, and you'll be a sign unto them, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. So Ezekiel's dumbness, that is the inability to speak anything but dictated words by the Spirit, his inability to make any personal comment to anyone except what God had given him to say, was going to come to an end when the man arrived from Jerusalem to confirm the destruction of the city. Well, that happens. Just come over to see where that is fulfilled. So coming now to Ezekiel 33, we see this. This is where you need to put the record together, because Jeremiah's back in Jerusalem going through the siege. Ezekiel's over here prophesying the siege in the most dramatic way with the loss of his wife. And then we find this, verse 21 of Ezekiel 33. It came to pass in the 12th year of our captivity, in the 10th day of the month, in the 5th day of the month, of the 10th month, that one that escaped out of Jerusalem came unto me, saying, the city is smitten. Now, connect that back to chapter 24, verse 27. God had prophesied that a man would arrive from Jerusalem with the news the city has fallen. So the man now arrives. Look what happens. Now the hand of Yahweh was upon me in the evening, afore that he was escaped came, and he opened my mouth until he came to me in the morning, and my mouth was opened, and I was no more dumb. So the night before the man arrives, and God does this to just prove to Ezekiel this is not chance. The night before the man arrives, he gets his voice back. But because everyone's in bed, he can't go out into the streets and start prophesying, he has to wait till the next day. And the man then comes and he's able to talk to that man. And again, God gives him a prophecy about that. But you think about it. Ezekiel's now got the ability to speak. You know, for those long years, he's wanted to go and tell the people everything that was in his heart. He wants to explain to them all the visions and all the mimes and the charades and the things that he's done before them. And now he can do it. And so he calls the elders together and they come. And they come and they sit before him again. And God has to warn him, don't get carried away, Ezekiel. Can you imagine, you know, everything that Jeremiah has said in his letter, all the prophecies of Jeremiah have come to pass, the prophecies of Hananiah are false, and everything that has been said by the prophets of God is now come to pass. The words of Ezekiel have come to pass. And now he's got his voice back, as God said he would get it back when this man arrived. And so the elders come and they sit before him because they want more news. And Ezekiel's thinking, at last they're listening to me. Well, look what God says in verse 30. Also, thou son of man, the children of thy people are talking against thee by the walls and the doors of their houses. Ezekiel, you think they want to listen to you? No, they are running you down. They are criticizing you. They speak one to another, saying, come, I pray you, and hear what is the word that cometh forth from Yahweh. And they'll come. They'll come and sit before thee as my people. They'll look like they're interested. They'll hear your words, but they will not do them. With their mouth they show much love, but their heart goeth after their covetousness. And you're just like a symphony concert to them, Ezekiel. They listen to what you say. Wasn't that interesting? And they will not do it. They will not change. They're no better than King Zedekiah. And that was the elder generation of those in Babylon, who would not go back in the revival 70 years later. You know, they were the people who would die in Babylon along with Zedekiah and others like him. So, you know, there was the disappointment for Ezekiel that even now, with his voice back, they would still not listen to what he had to say. Well, I want you to think about Ezekiel's great tragedy in losing his wife. You know, we as human beings think it's an enormous tragedy when somebody dies young. And it's a great grief because we miss them terribly. But if they die in the faith, God sees it quite differently. Remember good King Josiah dying at the age of 39 that he might not see the evil to come in the days of his sons. You know, God does take people away sometimes from the evil to come. And in God's eyes, the death of one of his saints is not the tragedy that we seem to make it in our very narrow view of life. You know, we hope to live long lives, but God might have a different plan. And sometimes God takes away his servants at a very young age. And Ezekiel's wife was one such. We probably believe she was less than 30. And this is how God sees it. Book of Revelation. Here is the patience of the saints. They that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this down, John. This is a comment for the saints of every generation. Blessed, happy are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. You know, we think when people die in the Lord, it's a time for great sorrow. But if they die in the Lord, it's a great thing that they've died in the Lord. You know, we recently had the loss of a young brother in his 30s. And, you know, the great consolation was that he died in the Lord, faithful in the Lord, because they're not forgotten by God. Yea, saith the Spirit, they rest from their labors and their works will follow them. And, you know, some interesting comments by Brother Thomas on that last little phrase, their works will follow after them. But what it's really saying is that God won't forget them. The fact that they die young is God's going to give them rest from their labors. They're not going to see the sorrows that others will have to see as they live out their lives to an old age. But that's God's view, that they rest from their labors. And so it was with Ezekiel's wife, and there was great comfort in that. But think also about the fact that God made it harder for these people by making Ezekiel speak in mimes and charades and mysterious prophecies about putting his furniture under a wall, the prophecies of the eagle that he gave. Why did God do it that way? Well, number one, as he said, because they are a rebellious house. They didn't want to know, therefore he made it harder. But when it comes to us interpreting these things, we cannot say, well, look, all these things are too confusing. We do have the explanations. We do have the commentary from Jeremiah and Ezekiel about these things. We do have the New Testament revealing things to us. And I just want to put in front of you my favorite statement from the Pioneer Writings. It's this one. The deity delights in stimulating the intellect of his creatures. Therefore, in revealing himself to them, he manifests himself mysteriously. And we can read these things and we can actually connect together the things that the gems that are hidden there by God. You know, God conceals things. We can search it out. Have you ever connected the desire of his eyes to their view of Jerusalem and their children? Have you ever connected the desire of the eyes, Ezekiel's wife, to what they would lose? And we can make those connections. And we pick up the fact that the man would come. And in chapter 33, he comes. And we see Ezekiel is very now optimistic that people will now listen. And God says they won't listen. And, you know, we can actually see these stories coming to light in a great way, because in God's word, these things are concealed for us to find and to draw out and to see the principles behind them. So there must be a love of the truth. And I want to just make this comment from Thessalonians that where there is no love of the truth, God can't work very effectively. And he talks about the apostasy in the 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Why? Why did God deceive them? They didn't have a love of truth. They believed not the truth. The difference between those in the world and those of the apostasy is they have no love of truth. They delight in lies and deceit and frauds. When you come to verse 13, we see the difference. What sanctifies us to our God? The word of God, the spirit word sanctifies us, and a belief of the truth. And it's that belief of the truth that makes us the people of God, God's own chosen ones. And we need to be thankful that that is the case. But we must have that love of the truth and that love of exploring the things of the Spirit. Well, it wasn't the only prophecy about restoration. I want to go on now to talk about Ezekiel himself, because in the end, the prophet Ezekiel had to learn that they would still not listen to him, even though he thought that they would. But I want to pick up and close now with the connection to Jeremiah, a very, very strong connection to Jeremiah. You remember when Jeremiah was trying to pray for the people back in the land, God said, don't even pray for them. He said this to Jeremiah, Jeremiah, your focus has to be on the remnant I will give you. It shall be well with thy remnant. I will cause the enemy to entreat thee well in the time of evil and the time of affliction. In other words, you will survive. If people stay with you, Jeremiah, they will survive. And it happened to everybody. All of his friends survived the Babylonian siege and captivity. Unfortunately, Gedaliah was murdered by the Jews at a later stage. Some of the rebel Jews that murdered him, Ishmael, murdered Gedaliah. But apart from that, all of those who followed Jeremiah and kept faithful to that were preserved through the siege, through the disease, through the destruction, and lived out their lives. Because God said, I will preserve your remnant. And it was Jeremiah's job to educate that remnant. And he did that. He went and he educated the remnant in the things of God. And he had that Sunday school class. And we've made this point that he had a youth group and a Sunday school class that included some of these people. Daniel and his friends, who were taken away in the first captivity in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. You've got people that must have been taken away in the captivity that followed, Mordecai, Ezekiel and his wife. You had other faithful people like Ezra that turns up in Babylon and lives through the whole of the 70 years. You had the ones in Jerusalem around him, Barak and Micaiah and Gemariah and Gedaliah. And you had the contemporary prophets, Habakkuk and Zephaniah, Ahiakim, the son of Shaphan. So you had lots of people that Jeremiah was working with, and you know, they were his youth group. They were his remnant. And that was God said, focus on the remnant, Jeremiah. Don't pray for these people. They're a lost cause. Focus on the remnant. And there's a great lesson in that. And here's what happened to Jeremiah's remnant. Look what this is, the most beautiful thing of connecting Jeremiah with Ezekiel. This is what happened. God said that those that he would send away to Babylon will be good figs. And God says, I will acknowledge them that are carried away captive of Judah, whom I have sent out of this place to the land of the Chaldeans for their good. So there was amongst the captives people like Daniel, and in the later captivities, people like Ezekiel, and then many others that would follow, who were sent to Babylon for their good. And God says, I will set my eyes upon them for good. I will bring them again to this land and build them and not pull them down. I will plant them and not pluck up. And of course, that was including people like Ezra, who went away and who came back. And God says, I will give them a heart to know me, that I am Yahweh, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God, and they return to me with their whole heart. And, you know, it's interesting that it says of those who came back from the captivity and went to build the temple, they came together as one man and one soul and one heart to rebuild the temple of God. So there was to be a transformation of those that God described as the good figs that would go to Babylon. People who could learn, not the elders, not those who came and sat before Ezekiel and wouldn't listen, the younger generation that God sent. From Jeremiah's youth group and Sunday school class, they would go to Babylon and God would use them to educate future generations for the return. And look how God said this to Ezekiel. This is the most beautiful thing. We won't go past that one. This is what God said to Ezekiel, talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Yet behold, there shall be left a remnant that shall be brought forth, both sons and daughters. Behold, they shall come forth unto you. What remnant is this? This is Jeremiah's remnant. I'm going to take them, Ezekiel, from Jeremiah, and I'm going to bring them to you. They shall come forth to you. And ye shall see their way and their doings. You'll see the quality of these people that Jeremiah's been educating. And when you see the quality of these young people, you shall be comforted concerning the evil that I brought upon Jerusalem, even concerning all that I have brought upon it. And they shall comfort you. Why did he need comfort? He needed comfort for two reasons. One, because he also mourned the loss of Jerusalem. But also he needed comfort from the loss of his wife. And here's a prophet that had no children that we know of. He's going to receive a whole bunch of young people who would come to him as sons and daughters and be given to him to educate. And he would be so enthused when he sees the quality. And God says that twice. You shall see their ways and their doings. You will see the quality of these people. And you'll know that what I did in taking your wife, I haven't done it without cause. And you see, he wanted Ezekiel now to focus on these young people and to make them the core of the revival. That when they would go back after 70 years, there would be the good figs who had generated the next generation who would go back in faith to rebuild God's temple and rebuild God's city in the days of Nehemiah. It needed a complete renovation of the nation, getting rid of the old elders and the kings that had so corrupted that nation, and replacing them with a generation of young people that had been educated first by Jeremiah and then given to Ezekiel as a comfort in his life. And he would be so pleased with the quality of those people. That's the story of Jeremiah and Ezekiel and the wonderful connection between those two great prophets, that the remnant would be sent forth to Babylon and given to Ezekiel. What a wonderful thing that is. And it just shows you the greatness of our God, the mercy and the kindness of God, understanding what Ezekiel had been going through in the loss of his wife. A great comfort and the great mercy of God in giving him that remnant to educate for the rest of his life. They had little contact with Daniel. He seemed to be so engaged in palace affairs that he didn't have a lot of contact with the captivity. You never read of any contact much with the captivity. What you do read about is Ezekiel being given this role to educate the generation that would go back to the land. What a privilege that was. And even though Ezekiel's prophecy went on for a number of years, we have no doubt that he was instrumental in shaping the good figs into those that would go back and revive the nation, the temple, and the city.